Rebellion was our greatest national tragedy. Stephen Crane recounted its full fury with unprecedented realism. Journalists documented the ebb and flow of its torturous cause. Walt Whitman immortalized it in verse. Soldiers and scholars continue to study its battles and campaigns. During the actual conflict, there was only one man who captured its moments of pathos and cast them in three dimensions. To be sure, there were other sculptors who fashioned busts and bas-reliefs of famous personages, but none achieved this man's national acceptance. Long after hostilities were over, artists such as Shepard, Kelly, Gall, and others executed fine bronzes and stone statues. But the man who is the subject of today's program, the son of an abolitionist mother and Massachusetts farmer, modeled the war for the home front of the North. His medium was clay, and his finished product was in plaster, bronze, spelter, and parian. During the war and for the remainder of the century, his works were legendary. Of approximately 90 subjects he molded, only 12 were devoted to war themes. The others were representations of drama, politics, country life, romance, all having a special appeal to 19th century America. The groups, as he called them, were well within the means of working men, and no modest home was complete without one. His molds reproduced over 180,000 copies, which were sold at prices ranging from $3 to $15 each. The war groups described had a nostalgic and emotional appeal to volunteers and draftees and their families. One was called Mail Day, and another the Town Pump. What mother could not imagine her son writing a letter or being befriended by a local belle? It was these few war groups that launched his career as a great American artist. And today, we tell his story. With water and clay, he caught the mood and pathos of the Civil War. He was the artful historian, and his name was John Rogers.
Thank you.
pleasant good day, everyone. This is your host, Mike Worf. On this April 26th presentation of Kaleidoscope, our theme, The Artful Historian, the life and times and the work of John Rogers. First to view the work, one was called the Wounded Scout, a friend in the swamp. 1864, a 21-inch to 23-inch group, was the most dramatic of all Rogers' statuary and enjoyed the widest acceptance. It depicts a black man leading a wounded northern trooper from a dismal southern swamp. The soldier is bleeding profusely from the right arm to which a tourniquet has been applied, and the snake is ready to strike the black man's foot. More than five distinct versions of this composition were made. The Wounded Scout was popular with the ladies and was often offered as a prize at sanitary fairs and other social functions. Mrs. Abraham Lincoln received it as a gift from a New York lady. The group was kept at the White House, though Mr. Lincoln was not an enthusiastic follower of the contemporary art fashions. Wounded to the rear, one more shot. 1864. A large group, 23 and a half inches in height, was the last Civil War group made by John Rogers. Originally commissioned for a monument, it was a tremendously popular piece of work in later years and was definitely his greatest post-Civil War seller. One reporter recalled interviewing a prominent politician, known to capitalize constantly on his lost leg and veteranism, while the general sat beside his wounded to the rear. This subject, though often the target of humor, was widely used in fashionable middle-class parlors to form tableaux. Examples still exist in the tawny butternut brown color that was used late in 1860s. Although this subject was never used for a monument, much effort was expended by friends of Rogers to have this group enlarged to life-sized proportions and placed at some suitable battlefield location. And so history was recorded. The Picket Guard, Zouave troops led by an officer. Two versions are known to exist, differing only in the soldier's head with changes in the cap and mustache. A soldier on one statue has also grown a small beard. Others included the slave auction. It was first cast in wax plaster, later it was hollow cast, and eventually dropped from sale because of lack of interest. Although the early war statues were painted a pale blue-gray color, Rogers later used a butternut brown, and most postbellum pieces were painted beige. The deeper the brownish coloration, the younger the subject. And so the ideas flowed from his mind as he recorded history, campfire, making friends with a cook. The wounded scout, the slave auction, wounded to the rear, one more shot, the sharpshooters, Union refugees, mail day, the artful historian. He recorded the times, as tragic as they were, the Civil War. Ideas would come and go for John Rogers, and tastes would change. The country was expanding westward. Industry was growing by quantum jumps. Veterans and their families were fewer in number. And the Victorianesque objects d'art fell from favor. So too did John Rogers' creations. Another factor that accelerated his waning popularity was the improvement made in the graphic arts. By the end of the century, his work, A Bit of Americana, became a lost legend. Today, there is a revival of interest in all of Rogers' works, particularly in his Civil War groups, those that we've described. They are rather scarce, some known only from reference in his correspondence, and each one uncovered today is an exciting art find. Rogers' new acclaim is well deserved, and it seems likely that his legacy to us will be appreciated as much more than just a footnote in the story of 19th century Americana. John Rogers struggled for acceptance as a sculptor before 1860. He helped stir the winds of war by producing his own version of Uncle Tom's Cabin in plastic form, The Slave Auction. Portraying a theme sure to play on Northern sympathies, the plaster statuette depicts a black slave with his wife and two children who are being auctioned off like cattle at a farm sale. Above the family on a devil's pulpit stands the auctioneer. In the center of the piece is a poster detailing conditions of the sale. The black man stands erect, his arms crossed, defiant and brave, with a ring in his ear, posed for by some black sailor on shore leave from a ship in the New York harbor. His wife and children, a gentle featured group, lean on each other and platform for support. Dominating the scene is the auctioneer, who leers with a thin, wry face. He wears a mustache, and his hairdo peaks into two goat-like horns. Turning the statuette about, one sees his handkerchief protruding like a goat's tail from the rear pocket. Rogers' art was explicit, and every statuette was a complete story in itself. Thank you. Unlike other sculptors, John Rogers could neither sketch nor paint. A master model maker, Rogers could make anything that could be conceptualized in three dimensions, but he could never draw one of his own creations. He was a pure sculptor, blind to all other forms of art. If one looks at any of his works, one sees flawless machine-like renderings. The groups he created were the product of the American Industrial Revolution, full of humor and stark Puritan realism, appealing particularly to the Native American farm boy turned city dweller, or city dweller wanting to return to the farm. Rogers was young and ambitious. He began to sell his wares through various merchants, and from his own studio, hiring ex-slaves to hawk his wares on the streets of New York. The abolitionist faction of 1860 immediately grasped his work as one of its own. His fame spread from pulpit to pulpit. Although the statuettes were sold for $3 each, sales varied from poor to brisk, depending on location. As his statues became more popular, they were copied and sold freely. Rogers had hoped to make enough money to support himself and issue his works in bronze, that most noble metal of the sculptor's art. Rogers had four distinct periods of work. One, before 1862, the imitation marble period, plaster statues sold and hand-worked. These were dipped in whale wax and polished. Two, 1862 to 1864, the period of the hollow plaster statues. Three, from 1865 to 1875, the hollow filled statues. These statues were filled with a lightweight investment cement. And period four, 1875 to the end of his career. This was the era of the solid plaster of Paris statue made in vulcanized latex molds. To appreciate the Rogers work, one must understand the problems he faced. Wax statues had to be hand-finished, a costly and time-consuming process. Spelter statues took about as much time to produce as bronze, even though the working temperatures were lower. One must never confuse a Rogers spelter with a crude, mass-produced Victorian spelter. Metal statues can be cast in two ways. Sand casting, while cheaper to cast initially, requires a tremendous amount of handwork and finishing. Investment casting, lost wax, fashions a statue in fewer parts with less hand finishing, but setup costs are much higher. Rogers could not afford to burn out and cast enough statues to make any of these processes practical. The market for this type of art in the United States during the Rogers period was very limited, primarily because of high cost. The sculptor, now inventor, struggled with these problems from 1860 to 1865. With this production technique changing so rapidly, art experts and collectors were confused. During these 6 years, he experimented with a great variety of plasters and spelters and bronzes, and only a few examples of his early attempts are to be found today. Two forces worked on his life in this period. One was the process used by Italian molders who cast his statuettes, moonlighting from the building trade. The other was Albert Metz, a pottery maker from Long Island. It was from Metz, whom he allowed to make Parian porcelains of his creations, that Rogers learned about these release angles in mold making. It was from the Italians he borrowed the lost wax casting process, the technique of making plaster masters, and the use of agar glue molds. From them, he also learned about founder salt used to harden the agar. He further discovered that the addition of Fuller's earth to the mixture improved its working properties. Rogers, eager to perfect a technique for mass producing his statues, worked side by side with these men. After 4 years of working with different bronze models, called variations but really differing only in degrees of draft, there emerged a genius on the American art scene. His progress was slow, but Rogers persevered and eventually succeeded. On today's presentation of Kaleidoscope, our program entitled The Artful Historian, a look into the life and times and work of sculptor John Rogers. Please press fast forward, let side one of the tape expire, turn tape over for part two of The Artful Historian. In the ensuing 5 years, John Rogers kept working, diverting the profits from the sales of his plaster groups to finance the production of bronze master models. He had disposed of his early bronzes, unsuitable for master models, because the release angles were not true, when an idea came to mind. Selecting the most popular of his plaster groups, he now made bronze models of each. They differed from the earlier bronzes in that they were cast in many smaller parts, hand-finished with angles and corners machined to watchmakers' tolerances. As did Samuel Colt, the gunsmith, Rogers began to mass-produce the many small plaster parts, which when assembled were an exact replica of his original creation. He developed a system of reinforcement to prevent breakage and perfected a means of construction that, should breakage occur, the broken parts would be held in place. He now would ship his statues everywhere. If damaged, they were easily repaired. His factory could supply replacement parts as needed. He made his agar molds to last for a day or more by treating the interior surfaces with founder's salts. Instead of wax, he sloshed in a fine grade of plaster of Paris. This created a highly detailed outer shell that required little or no hand finishing. He added a base, and the lightweight and strong statue was made to sell. All angles were corrected so that they never exceeded the working elasticity of his molding agar. When he was ready to ship long distances, he added lightweight cores of founder's investment to give the hollow statue's compression strength. It was the evolution of his engineered bronze master model with its glass-like outer finish and deep undercuts, which created illusions of being hand-wrought that made his plaster statuary lifelike and eagerly sought after. For the first time, it was possible to fashion a true sculpture in plaster. Nobody knows the whereabouts of Rogers' early bronzes. We do have some bronze masters and a very few bronzes made after 1870. But even his most popular pre-1865 hollow plaster groups are exceedingly rare. Only his heaviest and largest solid plaster groups seem to have survived, and though more numerous, they are not easily obtainable. His smaller groups, obviously more easily broken, have for the most part long since disappeared. The greatest impetus to Rogers' success came from those whom he thought were his worst enemies, the lantern slide and the stereopticon makers. You see, in about 1864, Rogers noted that his statuettes were being photographed and the pictures being sold without profit to himself. In an effort to protect his interests, he stamped into the base or molded into every statue a warning that the right to photograph the group was not sold with it. As his production increased, or if the plaster was too hard to impress, he affixed a label with the same notice. But the Yankee trader soon realized that orders were coming from people who had seen his creations only in crude, three-dimensional viewers, and that the newspapers and stereopticons were an effective source of advertising. In an about face, he offered his best plasters to be photographed at no charge. Middle-aged Civil War veterans, liking what they saw in the stereopticon, purchased Civil War subjects in great numbers. Although in 1866, Rogers' interest in war themes waned, by 1870 he began making more than ever before. By 1880, Rogers' name became a household word. With improved techniques, he mass-produced hundreds of his homespun statues. In recent years, Rogers' statuary has become rather scarce and sometimes costly. The Rogers Civil War statues are constantly reappearing and are quickly purchased by collectors and thus are lost from display. The best collections on display can be viewed at the New York Historical Society or at the Municipal Museum in St. Augustine, Florida. Yes, he captured the moment, he captured the time, and we are left with his work, for he was the artful historian, John Rogers. Once again, a view of his work. The Town Pump en route for the war, later known as the Town Pump, another member of the Big Four Civil War Rogers groups, 13 inches high. There are at least four versions of this very popular group, the variations having been dictated by production considerations. Parian versions were made. Return Volunteer, How the Fort Was Taken. Made in 1864, a 20-inch, three-figured group, very popular in the late postbellum period. The blacksmith is in comfortable short sleeves while the trooper before the forge is dressed in all four winter blues. Rogers apparently missed the point of genre perspective in this group, for the heat would have been unbearable for the heavily clothed soldier. The Country Post Office, News from the Army, in 1865, a 20-inch group of which two versions existed. The Sharpshooters, a 12-inch statuette taken from a woodcut of a similar name. It is the standard theme of soldiers using a uniformed scarecrow to invite rebel reply, thereby fixing a target for the ready rifleman. This group was not well received, and no more than a half a dozen plaster copies are in existence. Union Refugees, Mail Day. These were the figures brought to life in statuette form by John Rogers. A man of talent, of tremendous ability, and yet he had the insight to record the present day for the future generations. He was the artful historian, John Rogers. This is your host, Mike Worf, thanking you for joining us on today's presentation and extending to you an invitation to be with me again tomorrow at this same hour for another presentation of Kaleidoscope.